This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, James Wood, has been called the best literary critic of his generation. He's also considered one of the toughest. Now he's the one getting reviewed. He recently published his first novel. Wood is the book critic for the New Republic, where he's a senior editor. He started his career in London, where he became the chief literary critic at The Guardian after graduating from Cambridge University in 1991. He was 26. Wood's new novel, The Book Against God, is in part about the arguments for and against religious faith. It's about a young man, Thomas Bunting, who's been trying to finish his doctoral dissertation for the past 7 years. Recently, he's neglected his thesis for another project, which he calls The Book Against God, in which he collects religious and anti-religious quotations and develops his own arguments about theological matters. Bunting has gone from being a devout believer to being a devout secularist. Bunting grew up in a small village in northern England, where his father was the village priest. Here's a short reading. The character refers to his parents by their names, Peter and Sarah.
When I was a little boy, Sunday was a visiting day, and Saturday a marrying day. On Monday mornings, I often took a piece of wedding cake in my lunchbox to the village school. This was the spoil of my father's work on Saturdays. It seemed to me then that my father was constantly marrying and burying people, joining and separating them. In my childish mind, the dead and the affianced were equally half alive. They all entered the vicarage as reputations. Each category was treated in the same easy, genial way. "I have to marry Clendenin's son," Peter might announce at the dining table, while I, wide-eyed, legs dangling from the slatted kitchen chair, trying to do my homework, looked on. "He's gone and got Joanna, you know, Joanna in the pub, pregnant." Or once, as he came into the kitchen with his overcoat on, "Bill Clemens has died. What on earth am I going to say about him? He only came to church at Christmas." Death had no sting in the Bunting household, partly because Sarah and Peter sincerely believed in the resurrection of souls, or lift-off, as Peter called it, and partly because death was a technical matter, which called for an immediate flurry of organization and a swift obituary. Most of the villagers discussed were not members of the church, since hardly anyone came to church. The village was Peter's real church, and had to be.
That's James Wood reading from his new novel, The Book Against God. Now, in your novel, the main character's father is a priest. You were brought up in an evangelical Christian family in England. Your father was not a priest, though, right?
No, he taught zoology at the University of Durham, and in that sense, I suppose, he's a rather wonderfully Victorian figure, like something out of Edmund Gosse's book, Father and Son. On the one hand, a scientist, on the other hand, a fairly strict Christian scripturalist. I mean, not a literalist by sort of American standards, but certainly a believer in the veracity of Scripture. And I grew up, as I wrote, I think, in that essay, autobiographical essay in The Broken Estate, in a fairly austere Christian regime. Family life tended to be saturated in what now seems to me like a sort of Victorian language of moral pressure. So that I remember, for instance, my father telling me that when I was about 17 that my relationship with my first girlfriend was not edifying. Or, for instance, my mother telling me that it was bad stewardship to have an untidy bedroom because Christians were supposed to be orderly in all things, including their bedrooms. I precisely didn't want just to map that fictionally. That seemed sort of, on the one hand, uninteresting and unchallenging, and secondly, you know, create all the sort of family problems that one can envisage, because my parents are still alive. So what I wanted to do in this novel was really go to the other extreme, was instead to imagine a rather warm, undogmatic, flexible, rather admirable Christianity, and then put a child, or now grown up, but a narrator into it, a son into it, who, as it were, has no obvious reason to be rebelling.
But rebels anyway.
but rebels anyway. There's a risk here, and I think I may not entirely have pulled it off. Some of the reviews have suggested that I haven't entirely pulled it off. The risk, obviously, is that you don't give the reader enough, and the reader at the end says, as indeed I envisaged the reader doing, the reader says, but I don't know what he's complaining about. Why this is contentless. What's he got to be so worked up about? His parents are admirable. Christianity they espouse might not be his kind of belief, but I can't really see what he's ranting on about.
No, I'm interested if you're willing to talk about it in the church that you grew up in. You describe it as a charismatic part of the Church of England that was, quote, renewed during the late 70s. And you write, inside that church, I saw people shivering with ecstasies, people clutching at God with their hands raised, people dancing in the aisle, whirling and writhing, taken with the Spirit. I was disturbed by how many adults broke into tears during these services. It was perhaps the wrong kind of religion for a child because it excited in me two childish responses, fear and slyness. Can you talk about those responses, fear and slyness?
Yes, happily. I know the prospect of English worshippers cavorting around as if in a gospel choir seems a bit extraordinary, and it's true that my own parents were quite physically inhibited. It tended to be a sort of island of stillness surrounded by all the charismatic craziness that was going on. Nevertheless, that was the church they had decided to belong to, and it was the church that I, as a child, was exposed to. Fear and slyness, I meant by that simply that I think it is emotionally disturbing for children to witness adults breaking down. I mean, adults obviously aren't meant to do this, and so to see adults in tears is painful, and I think is actually disastrous for children. I mean, it alienates them from religion. And then the slyness, simply because, you know, in that sort of tradition, there's a great sort of pressure brought to bear on everyone in the church, even children, which is the sort of pressure of testimony, the pressure of witness. You know, are you called? What do you have to say about your decision to take Christ? And again, I don't think children should be put under that kind of pressure. And the result, at least in my case, was that I found it easier to lie about the lack of faith than to actually feel any faith in me.
So you felt no faith, but you lied and said that you did?
Yes.
Just so that
you'd be along with it.
You'd be good in church?
Yes.
And the people in your church sometimes spoke in tongues?
Yeah, they did. I never really, and still don't really quite believe in the notion of speaking in tongues. It's a characteristic sound if you hear it, and indeed it's precisely the characteristic nature of it that makes me suspicious. The fact that if you hear it done again and again, certain kinds of illogic, certain kinds of patterns and phonemes and so on tend to get repeated. I think it is a sort of a mass hysteria, really.
In your essay about this, you write that the sound of people talking in tongues, it sounded like a tourist's imitation of Hebrew.
That's very naughty of me, isn't it? I'd forgotten that I'd written that. Yes, I it's impossible when you hear it not to think that some vague idea of what a biblical language ought to be, a sort of biblical gibberish, is being unconsciously imitated. I mean, I sound very harsh when I say this. I don't think there's conscious deception here. I think, obviously, these people truly believe, are sort of lulled into a hypnotic state, and truly believe that they are speaking as the early disciples began to speak when the Holy Spirit came to them at Pentecost. I mean, the Gospels say that the disciples went out and began to speak in many, many different tongues. I think there's a marvellous line, I can't remember who said it, but there's a marvellous line about how there's nothing more cold and alienated than a choir boy at a funeral. And I think a child who isn't going along with the flow, a child in that kind of charismatic service, is about as alienated as a choir boy at a funeral. He looks on it with sort of coldness and professional disdain.
In your novel, the main character has lost his faith, even though his father is a priest. You lost your faith too, I think, at about the age of 14 or 15. What was behind your loss of faith?
I think, first of all, you'd have to say foundationally, what was behind it was not having had any particular experience of revelation to begin with. So there was nothing very strong to remove. I had no special feeling that God was speaking to me in a still small voice and that kind of thing. And then I think the second component was just beginning to try to becoming enamored of rationality, actually, which I think is such a sort of wonderful experience of growing into adolescence, beginning to realize that you can think for yourself. And I remember as a teenager, a bit older than 14, actually, more like 16, getting a piece of paper and drawing a line down the middle of it and putting the arguments for God on one side and the arguments against on the other, and feeling when I'd finished that the debit side was much greater than the credit side.
What was on each side?
What was on the credit side was the usual stuff. I mean, the notion that the extraordinary unlikelihood of the world being created at all, and the fantastical idea, which is still a bit fantastical to me, that that it's simply rudderless, that it's simply this chemical accident, and that we'll all that we'll all die into the dust at 70 or 80, and that'll be the end of us. The evidence of some kind of spiritual life beyond beyond the material one. I mean by that sort of the ghostly world, the extrasensory world that people seem to again and again have contact with. On the debit side has always been for me reconciling the pain and suffering of the world with any notion, any traditional notion of a God who is in charge, a providential God who loves us and commands us to love him.
And would you still include that in the pluses and minuses of religion if you were drawing up a list?
Yes, I would. I've never been able to get round the this basic question of making compatible the pain of the world with the notion of a merciful and loving God. I should say, you know, neither has theology. I mean, this is, it's something I read again and again. I read a lot of theology, and if you do, you see that this is an area in which theology is finally modest. It has to be. It sort of hangs its head and says, you know, we can come up with some reasonable arguments as to how we might make this compatible, but in the end, it's a mystery that we cannot explain. So theology admits this, and I think it's just a question for each individual human as to how strongly this admission of failure, in a way, hits one. It hit me very hard, and I've never been able to get around it.
Knowing what a close reader you are, and knowing that you grew up in an evangelical family, I found myself wondering how you were taught to read the Bible and what your Bible reading was like when you were young.
I had regular Bible reading at Sunday school and to some extent at home. I think above all, it wasn't just how I was actually led through the Bible. It was seeing how the Bible was invoked by my parents. I think that was an absolutely crucial thing for me, to see the to witness the power of those words. And you know, I mentioned earlier that certain words, which became intensely irritating to me when I was an adolescent, like this idea that, you know, having a girlfriend might be unedifying. Certain words became sort of saturated with rather oppressive meaning. And yet, when you think about it, how extraordinary that so much faith might be placed in the power of one word. This idea that, you know, the idea that my father might be able almost to dissuade me from seeing my girlfriend by using the word unedifying. So there was a real education in the power of language every day.
Did you have any favorite phrases, passages from the Bible?
Yes. I've always loved Psalm 90. That's the marvelous psalm for 1,000 years in thy sight, but as yesterday. We grow up as grass, but in the evening we are cut down. The grass is cut down and withereth. It's difficult for me now, despite my sort of formal atheism, not to be tremendously moved. I mean, I find it almost too overpowering when I go particularly into a cathedral or a college chapel, and this old, familiar confluence of music and language starts up again. It's really just overwhelming to me.
So when you're in church or in a cathedral and you have this kind of complete sensual experience of the beautiful architecture, the beautiful language, the beautiful music, do you find that reawakens in you a sense that maybe you want religion in your life, or can you see that experience as a purely kind of sensual, artistic, transcendent experience as opposed to a religious transcendent experience?
No, I think I do for a minute or two lose my hold on rationality. Music has always done this for me. It's of all the arts, it's the one that seems most to challenge the very notion of rationality. I mean, when we think about how a note is produced, what it refers to, where the notion of notes comes from, it's very difficult not to think that there's something. I mean, there's a long tradition of writing about this in music, but it's difficult not to think that there's something otherworldly about it. And of course, a large proportion of composers have been believers.
You became the book critic for The Guardian in London when you were 26 in 1991. That's a pretty young age to get such an important position. Is there a story behind getting it that young?
Not really. I started reviewing books pretty young anyway. It was actually my last year at university when I began to write a few reviews for national newspapers. When I left university, I started immediately freelancing for The Guardian and had been doing it for 3 or 4 years before being asked to go on to the books pages as an editor. And then I think I was just so keen to be regularly reviewing that I became the sort of de facto chief literary critic, and then rather pompously got the title appended to my reviews at the same time. I mean, that was a period of real sort of zeal in my life. I mean, I still clearly have that zeal, but you know, I think that was the time when I began to, I sort of got this reputation in London as this this sort of cheerless hammer coming down on you know, breaking up books like meringues, you know, sort of coming down on one novel after the other. And I was given in that youthful way to rather extreme statements, sort of say that, you know, there'd been no good English writing since 1945 and that sort of thing. This tended to get a lot of attention, quite a lot of it negative, as you can imagine. And it's a funny thing that when I'm reviewed now in Britain, despite the 8 years I've been in the States, and it happened just a few months ago with the publication of the novel, I'm still in a way frozen in that mid or late 20s period. I tend to get written about still as the as the enfant terrible, as the guy who laid about him with a sword. There's not much awareness of and sympathy for the kind of deeper and longer things I've been doing in the States.
This is your first novel. Did you have any reservations writing a novel after having passed judgment on so many of them? In other words, one could say you set the bar really high. How could you possibly reach that standard yourself with your first novel?
Yes, I did set the bar high, and as a result, it's come down like a guillotine on the back of my neck again and again. So there was a sort of standard. There was a standard review. It wasn't necessarily a negative review, but there would be a standard mixed review that would appear in Britain, which would always have the same beginning. It would say, Wood is a critic who has relentlessly raised the bar. He's always demanding masterpieces from writers. Is this novel a masterpiece? No, it's not. And then the rest of the review would sort of continue, you know, depending on how much the reviewer liked or didn't like the book. Curiously enough, I think that actually my writing about books didn't make it harder for me to write. It actually gave me more confidence. I mean, I know there's this notion that, you know, that the critic, you know, the critic can't do it. The critic talks about it, and the writer actually gets on with it. But on the contrary, actually living in the novel year after year, thinking about fiction, greedily reading it, appropriating its techniques in the way certainly that I've privately been doing that, ought to fortify one. My disappointment is simply that it took me so long. I mean, at 26 or 27, I was desperate to write a novel and did begin writing and didn't like at all what I was doing and tore it up and threw it away, and then began again at the age of 30, same, thought it was rubbish, threw it away. At which point I began to tell myself, well, you know, you may be precocious as a critic, but you certainly aren't as a novelist. You'll just have to be patient, bide your time, it'll come along. And I suppose it did, but I'd wished it had been at 26 rather than 36 or 37.
Here's an essential dilemma I would imagine you have to face as a book critic writing your first novel. As a critic, you really have to believe in the importance of the form of literary criticism, and you have to believe that what you're writing matters, it's serious, it's worth publishing in a newspaper, a magazine, it's worth collecting those reviews in a book, that those reviews are worthy of a life that might even outlive the novel. But at the same time, as a novelist, you have to believe that your novel's really important, and sure, a lot of reviewers will try to shoot it down, but you can just ignore that and have faith in the book, because you kind of have to do that to survive, in a way. So how do you reconcile those two contradictory impulses that you have to keep in mind as a critic and as a novelist?
I mean, that's a very good question. I do it probably by a slightly unexpected route, which is that I don't have complete faith in my novel. That's to say, I think I could write a pretty good essay explaining what's wrong with it. There are days when I'm sort of more positive than negative, but there's a lot that I can see wrong with it. And so I actually tend to be rather feebly suggestible when reviews come along. I tend to, you know, if someone says, it's overwritten, or someone else says, you know, there's too much nostalgia and retrospect, there's too much stuff about childhood in it, I tend to sort of come away from the review saying, well, he's right, of course, he's right about that. So in a curious way, I managed to turn your contradiction into a sort of paradox that I can hold together, believing in large part in the sort of basic integrity of my novel, but essentially believing that a good part of the criticism that's been written about it is likely to be accurate.
So do you think that writing this novel will lead to a change in the way you write as a book critic?
I think actually not, for all that I've said. I think you must feel that I'm just deliberately, throwing these jaunty paradoxes at you whenever you ask me a question. It would follow, wouldn't it, that seemingly that that I ought to go about being a critic with greater humility. And yeah, to some extent, I think I there are certain cruelties that I regret in some of my pieces, and that I think I will soften. I think in the main, though, it can't change really one's feeling about criticism, and that's because I think, you know, you're not. It's the great truth that you're not writing a review to the writer. It is unfortunate, humanly, that that the writer is being written about and you know, has to read the reviews, or perhaps chooses not to read the reviews, but sure enough hears about them. But you're not writing to the writer. You're writing to a public. You're engaged in a discourse, a rather impersonal discourse in some ways. I don't say that this is necessarily humanly defensible. It isn't, and people are caused pain. The only way of defending it is to say, I suppose, that I too have been caused pain now as someone who's been reviewed twice, having produced two books. So, you know, rather like the analyst who has to be analysed himself before he can, you know, go into his profession. You know, I've been there. But I do think, you know, it's a discourse that exists for the public, not for the writer.
Do you think now that when you give a bad review to an author, the author will be able to say, yeah, well, I didn't like his novel either?
You know, that's a very good question. It's something that that has given me pause. I do sometimes worry about whether I've undermined my authority, I suppose you might say. That sounds terribly pompous, but I think you know what I mean. Yeah, so that a writer might say, well, I didn't like his book, and, you know, look at that thing. I mean, you know, he's telling me what to do. He can't do it himself, can he? And it's true that, you know, as long as you haven't written a novel as a critic, it's all pure potential. No one really knows what your failings are. As soon as it's out there, they can get at you. Yeah, I think that will happen. But again, I think one just has to say that's the curate, you know, that's the sort of private relation of the, you know, that's the writer responding. But there is, you know, one's interested really in the end in the readership responding.
Well, don't you also think that it's a really different, really different set of muscles in a way that you use as a critic than you use as a novelist? They're both about good writing, and either you can write well or you can't.
Yes.
But, you know, the skills of a critic and the skills of a novelist, you can have both, but they're kind of different processes.
No, absolutely. And, you know, one thing anyway I tend to do, I mean, I have a fairly scholarly bent. I mean, I tend to review contemporary fiction quite a lot in the light of sort of great works in the past. And I think there are writers who I'm sure hate my guts, who've suffered under me. There are other writers who I've perhaps been hard on, but who don't actually loathe me, and who and who like I think who enjoy being demanded upon. And there's no doubt that, you know, as someone reviewed yourself, the review that holds you to a high standard is the real challenge. I mean, the danger then, I suppose, for me as a critic is that I get sort of, that I'm not open to contemporary writing, and that I sort of get lost in a kind of cemetery of touchstones, you know, these sort of great works of the past that I'm continually praising and not opening myself to contemporary writing, which is something I need to do, I think, more.
Well, James Wood, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
James Wood is senior editor and book critic for The New Republic. His new novel is called The Book Against God.